Well, good evening. Good to be back with you. Why don't we start reading the description of the birth of Jesus as it's recorded in the second chapter of Luke, the first seven verses, Luke chapter 2, verses 1 through 7. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration when Quirinius was governor of Syria, and all went to be registered, each to his own town. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed, or engaged, who was with child. And while they were there, the time came for her to give birth. And she gave birth to her firstborn son, and wrapped him in swaddling cloths, and laid him in a manger, because there was no place for them in the inn. The imaginary inn. Caesar rules over the known world, Western Europe and North Africa, and a bit further east. And he could call a census any time. He had one every year, so people could be counted, so he'd know how much taxes to expect and plan for. In addition to the annual census, he could call a census for any reason he wanted at any time. I mean, he's the ruler of the world. Why not? Well, one of the features of his census that we don't have to worry about is that a person had to, the head of the household in particular, had to return to his ancestral home. And if they lived in other countries, that's a long way to come. Galilee's not too far. Verse 3, they all went to be registered, each to his own town. Now, how many of you got the map? You all got a map? Okay, it's also up on the board. It might be a little clearer there. I've drawn in two red lines. Let's see if I can get this thing to work. Oh, it's upside down. All right. The solid line comes from Capernaum up here, Galilee, and Galileans crossed the River Jordan, where it's narrow, just south of the Sea of Galilee, and they came down the Transjordan side, down across from Jericho, and they crossed at the fords of Jericho and then headed up to Jerusalem. Now, that just looks like a little road, doesn't it? No, it's not. The dotted line is the route that Joseph and Mary took. And I wanted to put up that so you could see the topographical relief. You can see there are mountains all the way down there. This is the ridge route because it's the highest point in the land. And it starts in Galilee, which is a few hundred feet above sea level, possibly 1,000 feet above sea level in some places. But Jerusalem is 3,000 feet high. So they were going up. The text says Joseph went up from Galilee to Jerusalem. That's why they were heading up on the way home. It's easier. They're going down that way. That route was not much used because of the tension between the Samaritans and the Judeans, going back to the division of the kingdom. Now, they weren't actually at war, but they were very suspicious and of each other and hostile to one another. And strangers coming through their territory were not that well received. But in this case, Joseph did not want to take the Jericho road, because the Jericho road, just like the other road coming to Jerusalem from the coast today from Tel Aviv, from both directions. That's a horrible road, a dangerous road. It's a narrow, winding road with cliffs on one side and a sheer drop on the other side. There's no barriers. You make a mistake, you're going down several hundred or maybe 2,000 or 3,000 feet. Just for some light relief, I mentioned to you that I taught high school in England for a few years and made the mistake of taking a couple of dozen high school kids on the standard tour of Israel. And when we're driving up there in our bus, it was really quite terrifying because the wheels of the bus were right on the edge. And when we turned a corner, the front of the bus stuck out 6 feet over the gorge. Well, the kids started squealing and making a noise. And then, what do you think they did? They started leaning. They all moved over to one side and started rocking to see if it would go over the edge. I couldn't believe it. Anyway, there were robbers there, as we know from the story of the Good Samaritan. The road from the other direction, coming up, if you fly to Israel, you'll fly to Tel Aviv, and then you'll have to take a bus or a taxi up that road, which is equally bad. And I said to a taxi driver once, please slow down. And he just looked at me as if I was nuts. And he's still driving like a maniac. And I said to him, please, please slow down. He said, why? I said, well, we could be in a wreck. We could be killed. He said, don't you believe in God? He said, God has appointed the day we die. If that's today, there's nothing we can do about it. If it's not today, we've got nothing to worry about. We can do what we want. Now, there's a kind of logic to that, upside-down logic. I'm sorry, I'm getting... If something pops in my mind, I tend to go off and... it's a congenital defect. The Galileans took... did not take the ridge route. They took the Transjordanian route. And it took maybe 2 or 3 days. The ridge route that Joseph and Mary went on took 5 or 6 days because Mary was very pregnant. She was close to giving birth, so she had to sit on a donkey. She couldn't walk that far. So donkeys don't walk very fast. So it took them 5 or 6 days, but at least Mary was relatively comfortable and, first century comfort. I mean, it's not like your Volvo or something. Okay, so first, as you come down that route, you come to Jerusalem, and then if you keep going, you come to Bethlehem. It's a little town about 6 miles south of Bethlehem. It's easily walkable. And the name Bethlehem, means the house of bread. And it's probably called that because of the wheat fields that were pretty fruitful there. Allowed the Bethlehemites to sell some of the harvest to Jerusalem. That was the name. But the Bethlehemites were conscious of a rich biblical history. It's an insignificant little town, but it has a rich history. As I was walking into Bethlehem, I passed a cave, and I looked at it, and there was a little sign, but the cave was full of ultra-Orthodox rabbis. They would come down every so often and pray, because this marks the site where Joseph's wife, Rachel, died as she was giving birth to Bethlehem. So it's a historic site even today to many Jews. Today, however, it's occupied by Israeli soldiers. When the boys... Yes?
Is
actually, it's what?
North Tower? Samaria? Just above. Is that it? No, that's
not sure. No, it's south of Jerusalem. It's not marked on the map.
No, it's
not. No, that's a bit. Hebron is marked.
Yeah. Okay.
Hebron is, you can see Hebron below Jerusalem. That's much further. But, I saw it. I really issued this map for the topography. For the mountains. That's what I wanted you to see. I've got other maps that will show the cities more clearly. Okay? But thank you for the question. Okay. So, that's on the north side of Bethlehem. And you go into Bethlehem. I went in there to visit Bethlehem Bible College. And on Sundays, I went to Baraka Presbyterian Church. I still pray for the pastor and the son. The son has taken over the pastoral ministry now. Where did he get his training? It was somewhere in the Far East. And his wife is from there. Anyway, a few miles to the south is Hebron. What have we got there? Well, we got the Tomb of the Patriarchs. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the wives, well, apart from Rachel, they're buried down this very deep cave. And I looked down it, couldn't see a thing. I mean, it's very deep. And I still wonder how those who buried them there managed to get them down there without just tossing them over. They wouldn't have done that. They got them down there by treating them with respect. And I don't know what's there. I haven't read anything about the Israeli government sending people down there or anybody else climbing down there. There are soldiers guarding it. You can't just do what you want. That was its main claim to fame. But David also occupied Hebron for some time. And to the east of Bethlehem are the fields of wheat, where a certain woman met her future husband. Who's that? Ruth. Ruth the Moabitess. Unusual for, it seems Boaz was a godly man. He was a believer. Unusual for such a man to marry a foreigner when there was such hostility with the Moabites and the Edomites and the Ammonites. They were the children of Ishmael. They were descended from Abraham, just like the children of Isaac. They had territory, and when you've got territory, you've got to defend it. So, think of the local Bethlehemites living there with that illustrious past. Visitors come. It's an insignificant little town. But they'd be glad to educate you. But they also have a more illustrious future. They're familiar with the prophecy of Micah 5, verse 2. But their greatest claim to fame was, of course, King David. This was his family home. He grew up here. Now, the three most significant people in the history of, Old Testament history, Abraham, Moses, and David. And David got the job that youngest sons always got, looking after the sheep. He was the youngest of several children. And so he became a herdsman or a shepherd. And that meant he had to live tough. Wherever he had taken his flocks, he had to sleep there with them in lambing season especially to protect them from foxes and wolves and bears and even lions. There were lions back at that time. He had weapons. He had a club and a sling against these animals. So that'll toughen you up. Shepherds also carried a rod. That's the crook, you know, little bit like my cane, but more of a curve on the croup. That was used to guide the sheep, keep them together, pull them back by the neck if they were stubborn. And he might carry a reed pipe so he could amuse himself playing. The animals liked that. Steve, what's the name of that book I gave you by Douglas MacMillan? Not the Wrestling with God one, but the... Yeah, the Lord. Sure. The Lord is my shepherd.
But the one that's by a shepherd.
Yes. Right. He was a Free Church of Scotland minister who became a professor at the Free Church College, but he was a shepherd for many years. And I remember him telling me he had 100 sheep that he knew every one of them by name. And I said, well, how can you possibly do that? Sheep look exactly the same. He said, not when they're born. I birthed them, and I named them after what I saw in them. That's what a shepherd does, still does. And, of course, in Scotland, they have collie dogs that keep the flocks together, and it's really fascinating to go to the Highland Games and see what these dogs can do. And usually the shepherd just stands there with a little pipe and toots once or toots twice and tell them what they do. But the only dogs in the Bible are mangy, wild dogs. Nobody likes them. But we've bred a lot of different kinds of dogs since then. All right. David became adept at using his club and his sling, and that came in handy when he was faced with that giant of a man called Goliath, who put fear into the heart of Israel's leader, Saul, who was a big man, a strong man, but Goliath, it appears, was about 9 feet tall. And even if you're 6 feet, that's pretty intimidating. But David challenged him, just insulted Goliath at first, but David used his sling, killed him, cut off his head, and from then, he was the number one hero in Israel. He had saved them from their enemies. And so he became popular, and Saul saw this. Saul's a little paranoid, and so he sees David as a future threat to his throne. So he spent years chasing around the wilderness, which made David more tough and more resourceful. Eventually, he's crowned king in Bethlehem, his hometown, and then he rules from the capital of the nation, Jerusalem. There is a sarcophagus in Jerusalem, which allegedly is the tomb of David. It looks a little bit too modern for me, but maybe during the Byzantine period they carved it, I don't know. And that's another hangout of some ultra-Orthodox Jews. David's really a big deal. Actually, some of them are still waiting for the Messiah to come and rule Israel and wipe out all their enemies. Sad. I've got a note, Matthew chapter 2, verse 6. Yes, this is a quotation from Micah, you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judea, are by no means least among the rulers of Judea, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Now, how appropriate that God calls a man who's a shepherd of sheep to become the shepherd of his people. And he had other talents. As we know, when we pick up Trinity Hymnal and sing some of his psalms. Can't remember if it's half or one-third of the book of Psalms were written by David. And the most popular of all the Psalms, probably, is the 23rd Psalm, which he was able to write based on his previous experience. The more you know about shepherding, the more you see in that psalm. But later in life, he fell prey to sexual immorality. He was a great man, a great leader, but he was far from perfect. And it's really sad to see him fall like that. But he was forgiven. Now, fast forward from David's time to the 6th century BC, that's when the Judeans were exiled. Most of them were taken out into captivity. The peasantry, the Am Ha'aretz, a lot of them were just left because they weren't really a useful asset to the captors. But people of any value were taken into exile. And that's when the word Jew was invented. There's no mention of Jews in the Bible up until the time of exile. Yehudim, Jews for short for Judeans. And so that's when Jews were invented, and at the same time, the religion of Judaism. Well, in 538 BC, I think it was Cyrus who gave permission for all the Jews that wanted to emigrate back to their homeland. And 123 of them were members of the clan of David, and they settled down in Bethlehem. So they go back to 538 BC. Others of them, though, by this time, they're more numerous. They can't all get into Bethlehem. Some of them settle in Galilee. The two main groups we know about were those who settled in Nazareth and those who settled in Cahaba. We still haven't found Cahaba yet, but Nazareth has been populated ever since the first century. In later history, the Roman Emperor Constantine had a basilica built over the cave. And in 339, the Nativity Church was erected, much larger building. And then in the 6th century, the Emperor Justinian erected the building that's still today, with a few repairs and modifications. It's still a little shaky. It wasn't the greatest construction, but you can go in and there's a section in the basement where, you know, they've put candles and there's a star designed on the floor and, you know, they tried to make it look like the real thing. But the funny thing about churches that are owned by the Roman Church or the Eastern Orthodox Church, they don't have much lighting in the buildings. Sorry? Yeah, the lighting is supposed to come from the... that forces you to look at the lighting from the candles. There's hundreds of candles there. And maybe a few electric lights very high up, but they don't actually cast much light. So it can be quite creepy going through these places. But anyways, they're only just for ritual anyway. Now, let's think about the birth. But before that, we have to understand the Middle Eastern law of hospitality. Even today, that's a function of Middle Eastern culture. I'll give you a couple of modern examples. I was in... we're going to get to that in a minute. Thank you. I was in Amman, Jordan. I wasn't familiar with the city. And I was doing something that kept me up pretty late. So about 11 o'clock, I start heading home to the hotel where I'm staying. And apparently, the people of Amman all go to bed about 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night. So I'm by myself. And naturally, one of my great talents came into play. I can get lost anywhere. I got lost right there. And it's dark, and there's these little streets, and I've got no idea where I am. And I hear footsteps coming up behind me. And I was a little bit nervous. I looked back at the guy, and he wasn't paying any attention to me. And when he drew parallel with me, I said, "Excuse me, I'm looking for such and such a hotel." And he didn't break stride. He just said, "Come." And I said, "Well, actually, if you could just tell me where it is, come." So I went with him and went through all these little side streets, and it came out eventually at a public square, which was well lit, and on the other side I could see my hotel. So I turned around to thank him. Before I could, he said, "You're welcome," and he turned around and went back the way we came. That's the law of hospitality. Second example is when I was in the Isle of Wight, there was a Baptist pastor there who went out to the Middle East to be a missionary. He was not very successful. He wasn't prepared. He had hardly any Arabic. But his first, I think it was Saudi Arabia. I mean, good luck with that. I think it was the first day. Yes, he went out looking for somewhere to eat. And he found a restaurant, and there was a host who greeted him, and he had to reply in English. His Arabic wasn't good enough. He said, "I just want to sit down and have something to eat." So he said, "Come." And he took him to this table where there was another man sitting on the other side. Well, my friend looked around to get his own table, but they were all full up. After all, he hadn't asked for a table. He asked for a chair. Well, he got a chair. The man was just started to eat his food, and they nodded to each other, and the waiter came back and showed him the menu, and my friend couldn't read it. So he didn't know what to do. He looked around, and then he looked at the plate of food that this man in front of him had, and he said, "Oh, I'll just have that." Immediately, the man passed over his plate. And he started saying, "No, that's not what I meant." And the man's face fell, and he realized he'd really offended him. So he apologized, and they shared the plate. And he had just made his first Arab friend. The law of hospitality. Back to Bethlehem. Everyone knew you have to show hospitality. Even to your enemies, not just strangers, but even your enemies. And the New Testament somewhere has a commandment telling us to do the same thing. If some hobo wanders in here, we don't try to reject him. We say, "Welcome to the family." Or we might invite him out for a lunch, or be hospitable. That's what breaks down barriers. If Kamala Harris or Joe Biden walks in, we welcome them too. Or Donald Trump. Okay. Jesus gave an extreme example of this with the parable of the Good Samaritan. He took a risk of his own life in order to bind up this man's wound, put him in his donkey, take him to the inn, the remains of which are still there, halfway between Jerusalem and Jericho, and he paid from his own pocket for him to have food and lodging until he came back from his business in Jerusalem. Now that man put himself out. And Jesus uses that extreme example to teach us about the love of God. So, my point is this. When Joseph and Mary arrived in Bethlehem as members of the clan of David, it is ridiculous to suggest that they would have to stay in an inn, even if one existed. And I'm quite certain one didn't. They're found in large cities and in major roads. There's no need for inns when the law of hospitality says you're going to be invited to stay with somebody. So it's inconceivable they would not have received hospitality from some family there. So what was the problem? Well, the problem is that they got there after most other members of the clan of David had got there, and the spare rooms in the houses were all full up. And Mary needed privacy. And, you know, when you build a house, 3 or 4 bedrooms, one of them is used as a spare room or guest room. When it's full up, then you have to go somewhere else. Well, apparently there wasn't anywhere else. So the solution was one of the family said, look, you can sleep in the cave where the animals are. We've got plenty of straw. You'll be comfortable. And so that was the solution. Now, to modern Westerners like us, that doesn't sound very attractive, staying in a cave. But it was the warmest place in the house at night. Right. There's plenty of straw to sleep on. The water was provided for the animals, but the host would have given them their own jug of water. So Mary got the privacy that she needed. The only two people there would be Joseph and the midwife. As soon as the host family saw how pregnant Mary was, she sent out for a midwife. That's part of hospitality. So Mary had a successful birth. She called her son Jesus. Now, that wasn't in their immediate ancestry, the name of Jesus. It was the name of Moses' successor, Joshua. It's the same name. And it means savior, or he who saves. So they called him after a great man, but also they recognized who he was, even as an infant. Now, just a word about this business about inns. In Luke chapter 10, the parable of the Good Samaritan, it says he took the wounded man to an inn. And the word is pantocheion. I don't know if you can see that over here. No, you probably can't. You can see it? Okay. They took him to a pantocheion, and that is correctly translated as an inn. Okay, in our text here, we don't have that word. The word is kataluma, and that means a spare room or a guest room. Let's look at Luke chapter 22. Verse 11. This is Jesus telling the disciples to get the Passover ready. Verse 10, follow this man carrying a jar of water. He'll meet you. Follow him into the house that he enters and tell the master of the house, the teacher says to you, where is the guest room where I may prepare the Passover? That is the same word, kataluma. It's a guest room. That's a correct translation. Similarly, in Mark chapter 14 and verse 15, wherever he enters, say to the master of the house, the teacher says, where is my guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? So, on these two occasions, kataluma is correctly translated. Sometimes, technical words are not translated correctly by translators. And this is an example. In Matthew chapter 2, verse 11, we read when the shepherds visited, and we'll look at them. No, this is the wise men, the story in chapter 2. In verse 10 of chapter 2, when the wise men saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary. They didn't go into an inn, they went into a house. By this time, the other guests have gone back to Galilee, so Mary and Joseph were able to move from the cave into the guest room. So, Mary gave birth to Jesus in privacy and with dignity. She had a normal birth. She placed the son in a manger. A manger means a food box or a trough in the ground where you put animal feed. Well, they must have put the animal feed somewhere else because they filled the trough with straw and then laid the baby there after it was clothed with cloths. What does the text say? Swaddling cloths. I always wondered what that. What's a swaddle?
Wrap the child.
That's right. Well, why did they do that?
They like it.
They like it?
Yes, they do. It calms
the
womb.
They're back in the womb again, like the position they get
in. Interesting. Well, the other reason is back then, they did that to keep the bones straight. We don't do that anymore, I don't believe. But they had a fear of children being born with something wrong with the legs. If you asked infants to put their weight on the legs too early, they can become bow-legged, right? Yeah, they can. Doesn't happen very often, but we don't have that problem. We've got hospitals and so forth. So he was wrapped in cloths, as was the custom. What about the smelly animals? Let's think about that. Have you ever visited a farm? You smell anything? I'll have to check that out sometime. Anyway, but if you complain to the farmer about the smell, he's liable to say, "What smell?" Because he thinks the air smells like that. Well, Mary and Joseph were brought up that way too, and they were used to it all their lives, so that was not a problem to them. They were very happy with their accommodations. We don't know exactly how long they stayed before the birth, probably just a few days. It seems they stayed several months after the birth because of what Herod tries to do, to kill babies under the age of two, because they didn't know exactly when he was born, so he wanted to make sure he got him. Maybe they planned for Jesus to grow up in the city of David. Maybe he thought he would grow up there and be crowned there. Because they really didn't understand what kind of Messiah he was going to be. But, as we shall see, God had other plans. And we'll look at them the next couple of weeks. Tonight we'll just leave the Bethlehemites discussing, who is this kid? Is this really the one we've been praying for? Doesn't seem likely, but after the shepherds and the wise men, it looked more likely. So let's just close in prayer.